Good evening. This is Perry Hoffman calling for our ninth call in our winter series. It's bringing us to our 19th call for from last year and this year. So we're very delighted to have Dr. Kelly Kerner with us, who is really one of the forerunners in DBT, working with Dr. Marshall Linehan for many, many years. And before I turn the call over to Kelly, just would like to thank all of you who have sent donations in, and also encourage others to do it as well. This is the way that we can continue to provide free services for those through their generosity want to support the work that we do. Next week we will have Lois Choi Kane talking on mentalization with family, so hope you'll all join us for that. And it's now my pleasure to turn over the evening to Dr. Kerner, who will give a brief introduction on herself and orient you to how she's going to be managing this wonderful call tonight. Kelly?
Thanks, Perry. Thanks so much for having me, too. I'm really excited about being here. And it's a strange pleasure to be on a call on a Sunday night. I think of this as sort of the actual day of rest that ends up happening in my family. And there's something about it that made it feel special to agree to do it on a Sunday, and so I actually feel quite excited about being here. And so my topic, as Perry said, my name is Kelly Kerner. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and as the circumstances had it, I ended up in graduate school during the time when Marsha Linehan was writing her book, and so there were a group of us actually who ended up training with her right as things were kind of coming together. And consequently, we got really fantastic training and opportunities to learn. And so the topic that I'm going to share with you about tonight is on dialectics, and especially this balancing of acceptance and change. And as Perry mentioned, I'm going to want to have you guys send in some comments to Perry sort of midway through, if that would work for you, anybody who would want to. And let me give you her email address again. It's neabpd@aol.com. So National Education Alliance, Borderline Personality Disorder. So neabpd@aol.com. And I'm not much of a lecturer as a teacher. I like to have conversations, and so we're going to see how this goes. I have some things that are more activities, really, ways of exploring the concepts based on our own life experiences. And since I won't be able to see you nodding your heads or indicating your engagement or disengagement to be able to tailor things better, I'm hoping this will work for you. And, you know, Perry, occasionally I might actually ask you, you know, how's this feeling? Is this on track? And get a little feedback in that way. So,
sure.
Let me. Anything else I should say, Perry, by way of introduction? Is this?
No, I think that's great.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, then, I'm thinking that there's a blend of us on the phone tonight. There's people who work as therapists, people who are consumers, people who are loved ones of consumers. So when I was thinking about this, I was really thinking about how are we all in the same boat? Where is the way, in a very practical way, that one could use dialectical strategies? And people have probably heard dialectical behavior therapy referred to in many, that D of dialectical behavior therapy being diabolical behavior therapy and many other terms. So I wanted to, I will start soon with a definition of dialectics, but I actually wanted to start even before that with just grounding this whole talk in your actual experience. So if you guys are game, that's the way I'd like to try it, is to ground it in a very practical, how can you use some of what is foundational to DBT to deal with the toughest moments. And so I'll invite you to step into thinking about some of these tough moments in your life. I'll try also to, in case you're just not in the mood for something that intense of the reality of your own life tonight, then I'll give you some alternatives that might be a little bit easier, sort of canned examples to work with, if that's easier for you. Okay, so here's the first, and people have the handout, so I'm going to start, and I'll try and refer to slide number so you can kind of follow along. But I want to start with this first image of the kind of you are here graphic. And this, what I'd like you to think about a little bit is some place in your own life where you really feel stuck, where the pressure's on you to say, maybe it's a tension between yes, saying yes to something and saying no to something, or you have to but you can't, or you should stay or you should go. You know, something where there's this really, or maybe it's with another person, where there's really polarization. You're very strongly on one position, and then the other person is like at the other end of a tug-of-war rope, you know, on the other side. But if what I'd like to have us do for just a second is to, if you were to scan your life circumstances here for a moment and just think about, like, where are things polarized, sort of stuck between two positions, a yes and a no, or a stay-go sort of thing. And just see, can you find an example that is like that? One way to do it is just to grab a piece of paper and a pencil and to just sort of free write, just to think, okay, what's hard for me right now? Or who's hard for me right now? So just give you a second here to kind of find some area where things kind of feel polarized for you. Okay. And you may have more than one area. That's the case. You can pick one for the purpose of what we'll work on. And if for some reason you're having a hard time finding one, or it's just too intense or whatever, how about let me give you one, a kind of position where you have the sensation like you can't stay with the situation as it is. It's not tolerable. And yet, you can't change it. Okay? And you can fill in the gap there. It could be about work. It could be about a relationship, whatever. But sort of like you can't stay with status quo, and yet you can't move the status quo. That kind of, there are real problems with both positions, okay? So this is the beginning of where, if you're gonna end up helping out in a little while, I'm going to ask you guys to send in some situations. And if you want to, if you're near your computer, this could be a place where you could actually type some of this in, like a little synopsis, a quick synopsis of what the two tensions are, what are the two poles, okay? Sort of where are you stuck on the one hand and on the other hand? What's your yes, what's your no sort of thing, okay? So this, the basic idea with dialectics is that there are lots and lots of these moments in life, and sometimes they're momentary and we find a little way through them, but sometimes they're actually, it's much more like seemingly immovable truths are standing side by side. Like for some people, you know, there's the sensation of I really want to die, like I cannot go on. And sort of right next to it is the desire to live. And it's not so much that the person sort of oscillates, like they jump back and forth from one to the other. Sometimes it can be where they really are immediately, they're both true. Or it could be in a relationship, you know, it's like, I really cannot stand the state of this relationship. Every day there's a source of pain, and it's really bad for me, and I need to get out. And yet, right next to that is are all the facts, all the ways in which I can't leave. And then that. And so the idea with dialectics is there are these times in life where genuinely two opposing truths stand side by side, much like these walls there of their chimney climb here. So in this graphic in slide two, the person is climbing up between two walls and two tensions and using their feet. When you do a chimney climb, when you're climbing up between two walls, there's just enough gap for you to get in between them. You push with your feet against one wall with your back against the other and use your hands and you sort of inch your way up. And sometimes to me, when I think about dialectics, this is how it feels. It feels like I've got my back against, you know, whatever I'm trying to push for change, and my feet are against the other side of it, sort of in contact with the ways, in fact, I have to accept it. And it's this tension that sort of wears out my body, practically. You know, you just get fatigued. You're so trapped in this climb. And it can feel like, you know, like if you're making a very hard decision about staying or going in a relationship or something, or staying and going in life, you know, it can sometimes feel like you're having to, you know, you sort of push harder on one so it creates a little slack on the other, and you move your feet up, and then because you've moved your feet up, you can now move your back up. But it's this sort of, you know, it's almost like rocking back and forth sort of quality of inching, where every single muscle in your body is being used. These are the situations that I was thinking we might talk about tonight, the ones that are actually hard and where it's very hard to just jump one way or the other, that there's something inherent to the tension between the two truths that is makes it very hard to move. You really feel at an impasse. So this is about the point where I would normally say, is this making sense to people? So, Perry, is this making sense to you?
Yes, no, actually, Kelly, things have already started to come in.
Okay.
So you're making a lot of sense.
Okay, great. All right. So the idea with dialectics in this kind of in this way of thinking, one way that it can be a very, very practical tool, is the idea is not to somehow reach some sort of wimpy compromise, you know, maybe, you know, to take a yes and a no and somehow get to a maybe, or sometimes we'll do yes and sometimes we'll go no. It's although that's totally fine. It's like that's how a lot of life is. But the idea with dialectics is actually to, through a dialogue, through keeping a strong yes and keeping a strong no, and letting what's actually true about both of those positions, engage in conversation, engage in dialogue without either sort of prematurely compromising or sort of, you know, abdicating, how you just give in, okay, fine, we'll just do it that way, you know, without sort of tossing in one or the other of the rope ends, to somehow stay in that tension and use that tension to be able to come to a new position. So that's the idea here, and that's what I'd like us to actually practice. So, and what I'd like, here's how I'm thinking the practice part will go when we get to this, is you've got, I'm hoping that most people found some sort of thing that they can work with, a sort of two truths that are standing side by side. And I'd like us to sort of work through each of the, maybe you could call them strategies or approaches or sets of ideas, and try applying them to your situation and just see, you know, how does it resonate for you? Does it not? You can, there's no rules here about how, if we were each climbing this chimney climb, for example, we're going to do it in a lot of different ways, depending on our body and our strength and our circumstance. So not thinking there's going to be one particular thing that everybody's going to like or connect with, but maybe there'll be something amongst the different ideas. So right now, if you would, on your piece of paper, think about, so you've got, you know, sort of your yes and your no, your, you know, both sides here, these two truths. If you would, for just a second, take one side of that. Take one side of it and describe a little bit about what is true, Like, what are those facts on that side, the things that are actually true? So, like, if it was, the reasons for leaving a relationship, there'd be a set of things about the things that are hard, the things that are detrimental. All that would be on one side. And then on the other side, if it was a relationship, it'd be all the things that are true about leaving. The reasons it's a good idea is one way to think about it, but it's also the things that are true kind of at that very base level of your gut, like things that are true about leaving. You might not have enough money. It may be so disruptive to the kids, et cetera. Whatever your yeses or nos or, whatever your truths are, just flesh out what you actually know about these two sides for a second. And you may notice already this sort of tension, this sort of ping-ponging sort of feeling, or this way, as soon as you think of one, your mind jumps right over to the other. Like you assert very strongly, okay, so here are all the reasons why position one makes sense, and then immediately your mind hops over to the other side, and from that side says, yeah, that doesn't make sense because, and then it starts to lay out the other side of the argument. The idea with this way of thinking is, You're gonna really lay out both sides as clearly and honestly as possible, and then we're gonna work with some ideas with that. Okay. So this quote on the second page of the handout. So this is slide 4. This quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald is one of my favorite ones. The test of a first-rate intelligence is to hold two opposing ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. One should, for example, be able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. I just love that quote. It's very hard, though.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard. But this is what we're going to go for here, is to actually hold both of these things in mind at once, and then we're going to do a lot of different practices with it. And I'll just say the other metaphor that, for me, besides these kind of rock walls, the other one that really works for me is I think of these opposing ideas or these tensions, these ends that are seemingly opposite, as almost like my thumb and my forefinger, that sometimes you actually need the tension between a thumb and a forefinger in order to pick something up, to be able to, kind of move. And that's how this feels to me. Sometimes I need the two tensions. I need a strong yes and a strong no, and it's the tension between those that allows there to be something new. And, sometimes you have to hold, like opposable thumb and finger here, you have to hold something incredibly delicately. So as you're having the conversation between these two sides, sometimes it's like, maybe you're holding between your thumb and finger a little delicate robin egg, tiny, fragile, and you're going to be moving with a lot of care. And other times it's more like this rock climb, where really every fiber of your body is engaged in the conversation. So the first move when you find yourself in this sort of a spot, from my perspective, or a useful move, is to actually find your center of gravity. And I mean it like very literally. So if you're climbing one of these rock walls or if you're kind of in one of these tight situations, is to physically find where's your center of gravity. So right now, just where you are, if you feel where your center of gravity is, it could be a sort of where the fall line is, if plumb bob, that kind of heavy object that hangs from a line, like where's your center of gravity? For me right now, it's sort of low belly and my hips because of the way I'm sitting. So where's your center of gravity? And then from that position, if you just allow your attention to settle there, maybe you'd allow your breathing to just be sort of natural, but become aware of that area of your body, that center of gravity point. And the first place that I like to go when I am in one of these situations is into my body and into kind of what I think of as a dialectical stance. It's a very centered and grounded stance. And usually it starts with some shifting of my attention to my center of gravity and then just becoming aware of my breathing in a really gentle way. It doesn't have to be deep or special or anything like that. Just aware of my breathing, kind of feeling the groundedness of my physical body. And then to get a dialectical stance, I then, as soon as I kind of got grounded in my body, the next thing I think of is, okay, what's my purpose? Like, what am I about? You know, like, how do I want to be toward, you know, in my life or toward this moment, toward this tension? Like, what am I here for, so to speak? Like, at a very deep level, you guys may have different things that you would say to this, but if you would, the first, I find my center gravity, and then I find my purpose. It's like, okay, so what am I about? What am I up to? Like, what matters to me about how I am as a person in this situation? So that's going to be my anchor, kind of my feet on the floor. So if you're writing along here, I would just say, you know, is there some phrase that works for you that's sort of your purpose? Like, how do you want to be toward this conflict as a person? You're 80, you're looking back on it. You know, how do you want to be? What's your purpose? And, you know, depending on who you are and how you are and stuff like that, that may come easier. That might actually take some time to find it, you know. So I have a friend right now who's going through a really terrible divorce, and it started out quite friendly and compassionate and, you know, really thinking of the kids first. And then there's been a little something that has really just ignited such tension. And every single interaction at the moment, it feels like, is, it's almost like they're both coated with gasoline and they're walking around as if, you know, they had a match in their hand, and all of a sudden, whoosh, one of them will go off. You know, like, it's just very intense. And so, you know, for my friend to find his purpose again, you know, it's kind of like, okay, so what is my actual purpose? My actual purpose is to find a way through the situation that is the very best for my kids. You know, kind of, that is his bottom line. I have another friend who right now is really struggling with her mom who's got Alzheimer's, and should she go and spend more time down there, even though it completely disrupts her life, when her mom can't even really, you know, remember her from trip to trip, and kind of that's what, sort of like what a good daughter would do, versus, and there's some way it's true to her values, and then there's this other way where, you know, she's right at the peak of all of her other life stuff, like she's just in her groove, and so to break stride and actually disrupt her life that much is a huge sacrifice. So she's sort of trapped, stuck in guilt, you know, about how to move forward here. And so when she steps back and finds her purpose, you know, it's very deep. And for her, it's, I just want to be thoughtful. I don't want to make my decisions out of escaping discomfort. You know, I want to, if I'm deciding to not go, I want to be aware of it. If I'm deciding to go, I want to be not grudging about it. I want to be just thoughtful. So yours could be a lot of different things. You know, it could be just don't want to make the situation worse. So, but just for a second, you might ground in your purpose. So here, if I think about these tension, these really polarized positions, it could be on a team, like therapists are getting into a conflict about what's the best way forward around somebody's care or something, or it could be in a family, you know, where one person is really strongly on one position and others on the other. When these things happen, it's kind of like, you know, you feel it in your body, and my first move in those things is I don't try to necessarily relax because I am tense. I don't try to fight that, but I become aware with my center of gravity And then I try to straighten. It's almost like I feel like I'm straightening my posture a little bit because I'm grounding back and, okay, wait a second here. What do I want to, what is my purpose here? And so I find and sort of try to articulate that. And then I think of the other, the reason I have this sort of, those are my feet on my floor, like that's going to guide my, my purpose is kind of going to guide my body, so to speak. And then I think of perspective. And perspective here, I think sometimes takes a, you know, a fair amount to get your mind freed up, like outside of the way it's gotten trapped. So I have a number of different things I want to offer in terms of ideas here about shifting your perspective on the conflict or on the dilemma. Because sometimes as soon as something like this happens, it immediately becomes, you know, you are doing something to me. And it becomes very personal and very tight and very locked in. And the shifting of perspective that I want to talk about is where that might be true, but it's not the only thing that's true. And we're going to want to deliberately try to shift our perspective out of this sort of tight personal to some other perspectives on the same phenomena. Not denying those, it's just it's shifting out to view it from some other angles here. So, Perry, still do it okay?
Absolutely. Beautifully.
Okay. Okay. Okay, cool. So I think of this, you know, the thing that we just did, this sort of find your center, remember your purpose, and then we're going to start to move to perspective. I think of this as like, it really is like assuming a stance. So like if I was going to move a refrigerator, I would assume one sort of stance. You know, I'd be like hunkering down and getting ready to push. If I was going to be reaching up to the top of a shelf, I'd kind of be a little unbalanced up on my toes, you know, sort of reaching. And this position that I'm thinking of here is one of those ones that's like you're, you could move in any kind of direction. If you play basketball, you know that kind of sense where you're, or if you're a dancer or play tennis, it's this sense of like you're down in your hips, your body is relaxed, your mind is awake and clear, and you're kind of ready, you're sort of organized around your center of gravity in a way where you could move a lot of different directions. So we're first move is to kind of get unstuck physically almost into a more centered position. And then to start to work with our minds to get some perspective, to get, and I think of this as getting our finger, you know, the other opposable digit here going. And the perspective I'm going to pitch that comes out of dialectics is the sense that everything is actually caused. It's a very basic sort of philosophical stance, which is whatever moment we're in, everything that was necessary to have led up to create that moment has actually happened, and that's why we're in it. It's not like predestination or something, but it is that, you know, all the facts that had to happen to make me be so rigid in this moment and all the facts that had to happen to make you so rigid in this moment have occurred, and here we are, rigid and toe-to-toe and hunkered down. And so this sense of causation, sometimes it can be very helpful to sort of deliberately look at that, to actually shift our perspective, to actually look at, okay, so wait a second here. Why am I being so rigid? Why are you being so rigid? Like, what is going on here? And so I like to look at two places first. One is a chain analysis. This is the kind of, so I'm on the bottom slide here on slide 6. This is to the left. These are little microphages. This is a picture of little tiny microorganisms here. And I kind of like to think sometimes what's most helpful is to see how can I make this fight between us, this tension not so solid, or the tension within myself about something not so solid, but to actually look at all of the components, all of the strands that have contributed. So, you know, like why, if I think about my friend who's in the middle of this very painful divorce, you know, like why are they both so threatened right now where everything is just firing so much? You know, the, if you really start to look at all the things that are happening, or if you took one instance and really looked at what set that off, you know, a little comment has so much meaning. And why does that one comment have so much meaning? Part of it is all the history and the intense disappointment that led up to this moment. And then the other is this huge threat going forward. And if you really go through it with my friend, you see all the thinking and all the emotional responses, and it's actually not so solid. It's not his partner is a jerk. It's actually this incredible strands of shame about having handled certain things in the past a certain way, and disappointment, and then this real fear about how it's going to impact the kids, and then jealousy as they both start to meet other people. You know, it's like this, you know, a given moment of incredible rigidity is actually composed of many, many, many component parts. And sometimes it can be really helpful to just see that, I think of this as shifting to a chain analysis, to really look at the small step-by-step ways we get stuck. So that can be a helpful direction to go. And I don't know, Perry, if there are chain analysis forms available, maybe on the NEA BPD website. I know that Alan, in his book, The High Conflict Couple, and I think in the family book too, has some really neat family chains. So
yes. We haven't posted it, but that's a great idea for us to do that.
I think it's going to be really helpful. This is one of the main ways, to sort of shift perspective. It feels like you're stuck, and the other person's a bad person, or you know, something's wrong with you that you're so indecisive. But when you really look at it, and sometimes in detail, you can see, like, yeah, it is caused. Every single thing that's needed to make me have this rigid of a response is exactly happening. So one way to shift is to look at the small controlling variables. The other way, this is the stars over here on the right. This is from the Hubble Space Telescope. I find it incredibly helpful to look at pictures from a space telescope when I'm stuck. Just, you know, kind of gives me perspective just looking at how small I am. For me, that's really helpful. Anyway, on this side, this side I think of as more like this very broad, far-reaching way of looking. This is where you're looking at all of the things that are left out, the sort of very, very big picture of what are the causes that maybe you're not really seeing. So I'll just give you some examples here, and then I'm going to have you work a little bit with your situation. But like, for example, there's a guy I know who had a client where he was working with him, and the man was African-American, and he had really a lot of sensitivity, like just a lot of reactivity. And it didn't exactly make sense where it was all coming from until he started to tell us what it's like going through his day. He happened to be a person who had really, really dark skin. And what would happen to him, he'd go to the grocery store, say, and he'd be standing in line and say the clerk was looking at somebody else, but then the clerk would glance up and see him. And because he was so, and it's in parts of Seattle, it's really, really white up here. So he'd stand there, and then if a clerk glanced up, she would actually do a double take and kind of step back in fear because he was so dark. He also happened to be real big. But his day was full of these situations where he hadn't said or done anything, but he simply walked into the room and immediately people had this rejecting response, this fearful response, just because he was so dark. And he had this guardedness and an inability to relax that was completely well-founded based on where, if he was in a different sort of context where he did not stand out and he did not evoke this all the time, you know, then that would be a different thing. But so this kind of dialectical assessment, one thing to think about is how is it, what is the person that's, you know, what are you going through sort of day to day that is sort of making this whole situation so much more difficult? It could be vulnerability factors you'd look at. But, you know, sometimes they're cultural things. You know, if you're in a situation where who you are is constantly rejected, maybe it's your spiritual orientation, or maybe it's your sexual orientation, or maybe it's your, you know, kind of just how you tend to approach things. You know, you're more emotional than people are comfortable with or something. You know, like, if the environment is constantly sort of a rejecting environment, it really gets you guarded in a way that you're already prepped to have certain types of fights, maybe, for example, like he was. So this dialectical assessment has you start to look at what are cultural factors, what are things that are happening that are not maybe immediately obvious but are still are big influencers. another example of this one. I have a person who I'm working with where I did not know this, but her family went to go to be supportive of her sister. Her sister called her up to have her come over. When she went over to help her sister out, her sister was really, really, really distressed and actually suicidal. And what came out through the conversation with the client was that that for a long time there was almost like a competition of who was sicker. I had no idea. I had no idea that there was this family dynamic. And it made a lot of sense of sort of how much comparison to others there has been for her in her whole life and how rapidly her mind goes to this kind of comparative stance. But we'd never, it never come up about how she was with her sister. Stuff like this, there are many, many controlling variables, things outside of, you know, that are making the person sensitive, that are making the person be the way they are, that we don't actually know. So sometimes looking at the stars, this one on the right, this moving toward really searching for the other controlling variables, to me, I almost think, you know, there's got to be something that is, that like if something's not understandable to me about somebody else's position or my own, sometimes it's that I'm really down on myself or something, I try to have this basic assumption, there must be something. There must be something I'm not seeing, something I'm not understanding that is making this so tight on the other person's side. And I try to dream up what that is or assess what that is. So that's what I want to try a little bit. It's, I think of this as going from something being sort of solid, you know, this is a problem or that person is a problem or I am X, you know, like indecisive or whatever, coward, you know, like whatever those things are, these sort of solid things. And then I try to shift into the ways in which they're not so solid, either by looking at the small controlling variables of a single instance or maybe shifting out to search for these other things that are kind of bigger picture. So I'd like to just pause for a second and see if anybody could maybe describe... Think about describing going one way or the other with your, just thinking this through with your particular dialectical dilemma, your stuck place. Would it make sense to you to do a sort of take a look at a specific instance? Or on the flip side, does it make sense? Is there any way where immediately your mind is drawn to, okay, if I were to look at all the reasons the other person is the way they are, all the reasons why I can't leave, you know, that abusive relationship or whatever. Kind of expanding your view or going down in a tight view of controlling variables here. This is a place, Perry, where I think it might be helpful if people were willing to maybe send in some of these so that we could take a look at
sure.
A few specific dilemmas people have and be able to sort of work a little bit with them. So I'd really encourage anybody who's willing, you know, you could send those to Perry and then she'll paraphrase or work with them.
Well, now would you like me to read some of them to you, Kelly? Would that be most helpful? Or you prefer them by email?
Yeah. So let me, have you already got a few then? Listen in?
Yeah. But,
okay, cool. Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so here's where somebody's stuck. My mini BA regarding controlling variables in my situation, in my dad is a history of vulnerability, him not being there to raise me in early years. I'm determined not to sell out my kids to take care of him. I'm very hot around this issue. I can get angry just thinking about it.
Okay, nice. So there, on the one hand, it might be moving to take care of the. So maybe, Perry, if you can, since you've got it right there, if you were going to say, okay, on the one hand and on the other hand.
Oh, so on the one hand is having a history of vulnerability with her dad, not being there when she was young, and now that and on the other hand, the dad may be needing help to be taken care of now, and she's okay. Very hot around this push and pull, I guess. The relationship tension between her dad, she cannot take care of him.
Okay, so there's, he needs care, and
that's
cannot,
what it seems like.
Yeah, and I cannot give that care.
Yeah.
So this would be a really, so of course my mind automatically goes to all the reasons why I can't give the care. You know, he wasn't there, it would impact my kids negatively, you know, we're starting to get some of the things that go along that side about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, if we were going to, that side seems like to me that we might, if we were really in this stuck situation, the first place I would think about going when polarized, so now I am on slide 9, when polarized,
mm-hmm.
The first move is to actively describe and validate what is valid, and what you want to do is you want to get a head nod from each side of this, is how I think about it. So if we were going to do that, then for this person what I would say is, okay, so makes complete sense you don't have energy, given how absent, to be called upon now when you really yourself had not gotten the kind of care and support that you needed is very difficult. And of course, you would not be, you know, immediately pulled toward that. The ways that you're anticipating the caring will actually be a detriment to your kids, where somehow you might end up inadvertently not being there for them because you're distracted and tied up with that kind of care. Like, this makes absolute sense. And is there more? And so on this side, before you would move, especially since this is a side that's kind of hot, I would really stay with it and validate until that side had its voice, so to speak. You know, where really, that yes, you get it. Like, if I was interacting with this person, or if it was me and I was interacting with myself and I was doing self-validation, I would keep on that side until I'm really getting the head nod, like, yes, you exactly get it. That's exactly why this is not reasonable, or it's not something I want to do, or why it's really important that I not do it, you know, until the person is nodding their head. And then I would switch, but you got to get the head nod first, I think, so that the person knows that, and they sort of have a feeling like, I really do get what is important to you and essential to you about this whole thing. And I'm not going to try and argue you out of it. And I'm not going to try to let you make you talk you into something you don't want to do. And like, you really leave. You leave the wall where it is, and you're just putting your feet against it. So you've got that tension against the wall. And then you switch over to the other about the needing care. And on that side, you know, is this, it could be it's a pressure from other people, or it could be one's own values, or sort of, you know, like maybe there's some way where even if somebody's not a decent person, to you, you still feel some sense of, I don't know, maybe there's a moral in there about how you want to live your own life, about you still do extend yourself, and you do it in whatever ways you view as a decent person would, or I don't know what beliefs. But I would want to articulate then, is there anything that is important on that side for this person, for her? Not, you know, and then some of what might be important is maybe there are important people who view it as important, you know, or she wants to be a model for her kids, you know, like, mm-hmm. This is how you be a decent person, or whatever. This is, you know, there's no, on this type of thinking, there's no, I don't think, any a priori. You're really trying to find out what is actually there for the person,
mm-hmm.
on that other position. And again, on that one, you're not pushing, you're not doing anything except really trying to get this valid, all the valid points. So I don't know if this is making sense.
Would you like another one, Kelly?
Yeah, let's do another one.
Okay, so I was in a domestic violence situation and I've lost my case. I have to trust the person who has hurt us. I'm extremely fearful of my husband. He has said he wants to work on our relationship. I start to shake being in the same room with him. I feel very stuck. The kids keep saying he is nice now, but my mind is, how long will it last?
Yeah. Okay. Will it last? This is a really... So, I think this is a really good one. This one feels like, to me, the same, you know, like, how do you move toward trust?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are definitely ways of building trust that require the other person to be trustworthy, you know. Like, before trust is warranted, you have to see the person actually get triggered and then not respond violently, for example. And, you know, so this is one of those moments where, you know, like, I might go to validate the fearful side first, the doubting side, you know, there may have been a lot of times that this has been said before, depending on sort of what has happened. There's a lot of reasons why fear comes up,
mm-hmm.
why distrust is there, and skepticism maybe, and a feeling of not having sufficient protection and not having enough plan for how you're going to get through it without some violent incident happening again. So, like, all of those sorts of situations, and then also the added fear of feeling like you spoke up, but then you didn't get, the system didn't respond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that almost always makes people feel way more vulnerable. It's like, okay, so if I speak up and now I didn't even get the response.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's all of that on that side. And then not knowing the actual danger, you know, of course, my immediate response too on this is to want to encourage reaching out. Like, so in our area, there's a county that's really known for not being active on domestic violence. And so anybody in that county actually has to reach out beyond their county to get effective help. So, you know, there's part of me that would want to assess a lot more to find out, like, okay, so what is the actual danger and how could we get more of a plan? And, Perry, I don't know if you guys have some resources on the website.
No, we really don't.
Okay.
Be nice if we did, but not, no, unfortunately.
There's some
don't.
Really great national, I might send these to you just so you have them.
Oh, great.
There's some really nice stuff on just really being able to create a good safety plan. So
mm-hmm.
even though you might not be able to get the help from outside, you know, like, what could you do on your side? So I'll just leave that on that. But just to keep going with this example, so that's all the valid, I'm sure there's a lot more that could be said that would be valid on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other, the kind of opening one's mind, this is, again, I wouldn't want to push this. I would want to find for this person, like, what's actually true. You know, is there on the side of staying open or staying, you know, of being open to there being a possibility of some sort of change? You know, like, what is it that's on that side? Like, what is valid about that? But this one feels, to me, this feels like one of those little delicate robin egg sort of things.
Right.
Because...
Yeah.
It sounds like there may already be so much pressure to just, you know, step back in, make it work, all the rest of that, that I would really hesitate to go toward that side before I really understood all the reasons why the fear is still there.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I have another one, Kelly, but if you have resources for us, please send them and we'll post them.
Okay, I will. I definitely will.
Okay, so here's, would you like another one?
Well, let me just say, I want to say one quick set of teaching stuff. So people
yeah.
are seeing a little bit of this, the idea with this, with the basic sort of day-to-day or practical dialectics is how I think about it. When there's a polarized position either inside of you or between you and somebody else, what I'm proposing is not to try and argue out of either position first, that the first move would go toward really validating exactly what is actually valid about both positions. And sometimes it's going to be really hard to see what's valid, and you're going to have to work at it. You know, but there's some way that rigid position has been created, you know. So there's, and you want to seek that out and see if you can articulate it. It does not determine where you're going to, what you're going to do at this point. What you're really trying to do is, in a dialectical way of thinking, is get both of those opposing positions on the table where you could get a head nod. And then, if you look at slide, let's see, what would this be, 8, this is when you're stuck. This thing between validation and problem solving, the one that's on the bottom, sometimes you're going to do a lot of acceptance, and sometimes you're going to do hardly any acceptance, and this all change. So if we stuck with that domestic violence one for just a second, like I could imagine if now we're trying to bring together the two sides of the dialectic, it could be that many, many, many aspects of change are going to have to be in place before there can be anything like a kind of trusting, unguarded response. So, you know, it could be that I have to have on the change side, could be that I have to have a safety plan that I'm going to follow regardless of what my partner does. It could be that there's going to be some sort of commitment to working together in therapy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There may be like a lot of change-oriented things, you know, very clear way of taking a time out the next time one of the triggers comes up that in the past led to a violent episode, and that the other person who was the batterer actually handled that whole trigger better. So, or if we switched over to the needing care position example, like on those ones, if you really looked at, given the things that are potentially threatened by reorganizing to provide care, you know, like what would be required on the acceptance side if this is where we'd have to really work the example with a person, but if there was something that was really important for that person's integrity to somehow do something that was decent, maybe not to do as much as was asked, but from her own standards, there was something that really mattered to her to do in terms of setting an example for her kids or something like that, then, you know, like how could she go about making the sorts of acceptance moves, you know, that would be required to allow that type of change. So with this dialectics, the idea here is to really flesh out solutions that would solve it from one side and solutions that would solve it from the other side, and so that when you come up with a final solution, it's balancing both acceptance and change. So it could be, like, if I think about the caring, it could be that I'm going to accept that I'm going to do a lot less than many of the people important in my life think I should do, and they're going to have opinions about that. That's how it's going to be. And all the reasons for their opinions come out of their own history, and they're caused, and I could go through and kind of either look to the stars or look to the macrophages. You know, like, they're understandable. That's how they respond. And my taking this stance means I'm going to be due that they will have some comments for me. And I accept that. That's how that is. I don't like it. But it's really important not to go past my limits on this one because I feel like my kids are at stake. I don't want to divert my energy. So the idea with these types of, or it could be exactly the opposite. Like maybe it becomes really important to extend past your limits for some reason. But the dialectic idea here is that you validate both positions, find solutions that might work for both positions, and then the blend has to be something that really genuinely incorporates for you what is valid about both sides. So, Carrie, the last comment I was going to have here, and then we can just open again up for questions and comments. This last slide that I wanted to point to was the symbol of the hands holding, clasping. Because to me, dialectics has this quality to it also. Sometimes it's the rock and the hard place, like climbing a chimney, and then other times it's much more of this hands clasping, this idea of holding or being with a difficult situation, you know, something that is not going to change as fast as I would like, something I can't fully accept, and that the quality of bringing a compassionate sort of clasping energy to that dilemma. I think that in itself, I think of this as allowing natural change sometimes it's like cooking potatoes is how I feel about it. Sometimes the situation actually is difficult. You know, I'm thinking about stretches of kids' lives, you know. Like there can be stretches where it is just hard, and there's you do everything you can to make it better, both on the acceptance and the change side, and that's as good as it's going to get. And if there's a way to be with that in a compassionate way, accepting what you have to, changing what you can, you know, accepting what you can, changing what you have to, you know, back and forth like that. But if there can be this energy of trying to be with it back to your purpose, you know, in a compassionate way, for example, then that kind of a gesture, that's the other gesture that I often will do when I'm in these spots, is I will just, I'll hold my own hand in this kind of a gesture. And figure, I mean, this is the part where I don't try to make it any better or, you know, change it. It's just as I'm being with it, and that there's something about being with something compassionately that can be like cooking potatoes, that there's something about staying with it compassionately over time that can transform the situation. Things changed. They didn't change because I changed them. They just changed. Or maybe there's some way where me being able to stay connected and stay compassionate to myself or to the other person actually allowed there to be enough wiggle room to actually move on up that chimney. So that's, Carrie, that's what I had to share.
Okay, well, so, that's terrific. There's one question that's coming in about one of the slides maybe you could expand on, Kelly, and that's slide 11, where it says the whiff of not enough and the other side is mental anguish.
Yeah. So I wasn't sure how much we might go into this, but this is coming straight out of a mindfulness meditation perspective. Mm-hmm. Of often there are habits, like something will come and it might be just, you know, slight dissatisfaction, almost like a little hint, all the way up to extreme mental anguish. And when that fires, you know, when something that we touch or see or hear fires that gives rise to either a little pain or a lot of pain, often we have some habits of either pushing away or trying to fix it so we feel better or longing for something better, you know, this sort of habitual ways of trying to escape what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of mindfulness is somewhat this gesture that I was just talking about, that if you can bring that kind of compassionate awareness to something over time where we stop engaging in our sort of habits, or we might engage in them, but then we switch back to a more dialectical stance,
mm-hmm.
of remembering things are caused, remembering what our purpose is, and then trying to find what's valid in the two positions, sometimes that can give rise to conversations where things will change.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that first move that we have to do is actually to let go a little bit, or we may do our escape, you know, like my friend who's got the hard divorce, you know, his first thing is he wants to snap right back when he's attacked. He has to let that go. He may say it, and then he just has to apologize, I'm so sorry. And then he has to find the center again, and then he has to reconnect to his purpose of his kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then speak from that position. So this idea with mindfulness, or this kind of compassion, self-compassionate awareness, is to again and again come back to that awareness of what we do that might be contributing to the problem, and trying to not escape, and instead go back to trying to validate the two positions.
Mm-hmm.
The things that make us drop the rope and just appease or acquiesce, or, you know, get in there and duke it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think then there's also, how do you inspire people to embrace the concept of acceptance?
Say this again?
How do you inspire people to embrace the concept of acceptance?
Embrace the concept of acceptance. How do I inspire them? I've never thought of that question exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Did it happen at all in this talk? Because this might be an example of how I might do it. If I was, I think what I try to do is actually validate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that's actually what I'm just thinking. My daughter had a very, very difficult moment of non-acceptance. And, I mean, just like earlier today. And I tried to be accepting of it with her. So I didn't really try to inspire her so much as I tried to find what was valid about it and then help her see all the other parts too. So for this particular one, it was really intense disappointment
mm-hmm.
and irritation. And then there was a way, after validating that, that there was a way to shift to look at all the causes that led up to this instance. And so I think it's that move that what I guess I would say is that looking at the causes was pretty helpful in that after validating, looking at some of the causes that led up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think I think parenthood teaches you the best way to try to the need for acceptance, especially as children get older.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I wouldn't say mm-hmm. there's much mastery experience involved in this.
Right.
It's all coping model.
Well, Kelly, I want to thank you, but before we sign off, I do want to put a plug for your book. Even some people emailed me and said, oh, my goodness, this is the woman who wrote that wonderful book. So do you want to tell people the title and how they can order it? It really is one of the best books out there for everyone.
Oh, thank you, Perry. Yeah, it's a book called Doing Dialectical Behavior Therapy, a Practical Guide. So Doing Dialectical Behavior Therapy, a Practical Guide. And it's on Amazon or, you know, wherever books are sold. And on Guilford Press is the other. So, I'd be thrilled if people were interested in the book. A lot of this that we were talking about, the dialectics, is spelled out in more detail there,
mm-hmm.
and as are some of the other aspects of DBT.
And it's the most user-friendly book, I think, that's out there on doing this. So it's just anybody who's interested really should include it in their library. Well, Kelly,
okay.
I want to thank you, and we have the wonderful good fortune of having you and Charlie Swenson back in 2 weeks and doing some monthly educational seminars for us. And I think I can't even express how exciting that is. And
oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited about that too. It's going to be a lot of fun. I think we may have to do a duet.
Okay, that's a deal. That's a deal.
Okay,
so we'll look forward to hearing from you again in 2 weeks. And again, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Perry, if people have feedback, too, about anything that was helpful or off for them, I'd love to get it.
Okay, please, everybody hear that Kelly would love feedback. So if you send it to me, I will forward it on to her ASAP.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay,
everyone have a good night.
Bye-bye, Al.
Bye.